an idea. Oh,
Oh,
okay.
I didn't want to miss what you were doing. Sorry. Were you getting started?
Yeah, I am getting started. We're getting. I'm always getting started. Get the party started.
Always getting started. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Lost Explorers. My name is J. David Osborne. That's Chris Saknussemm, and we have a very special guest. Chris, would you like to introduce our guest?
I would. Matthew O'Brien, a really wonderful Las Vegas writer colleague, the author of Beneath the Neon, amongst other works, a really important and interesting folkloric treatment of one of, I think, one of the most interesting subcultures in America, people who live in the storm drains of Las Vegas. He's done two other books. He's a teacher, an editor. And while I met him in Las Vegas, and I'm really so excited about the last visit he made here, he actually lives in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. And we're going to be talking with him about the expatriate experience shortly coming up. But Beneath the Neon, I think, is a really special book that people should check out because it's on the edge of some things that are really important to all of America now. I play musically with a lot of homeless people now. This is a very interesting anthropological work that really addresses some deep issues in the American psyche. So we're going to get to that in a moment. But meanwhile, we have to do our regular segments so Mr. Osborne doesn't get a pass because we have a special guest. So the band name for this session is called Impersonal Lubricant. And it's based on an idea that I've actually done where I took Dan Savage, the famous sex advice writer of The Stranger, I took some of his pieces. And I just juxtapose them out of sequence with other questions. So there's kind of a non sequitur idea going on. And then some pretty basic, synthesized music underneath. And I think it's really hypnotically interesting. I'm doing this, and I think Mr. Savage would be very upset, but I don't care because it's fun. And people should be a little bit more humorous about things and just let it go. He's so certain he's always right about his advice. Well, he is right about it, as often. I've just put in different questions, and I think that's what's really funny. So, yeah, Impersonal Lubricant is the band. Here's the aphorism. Every lesion is a lesson. Yeah.
Like it. That's good. That's good.
Thank you.
Hey, there he is. What's
Hey,
up, buddy?
there's Mr. O'Brien. See, I told you he was so, he's so much better looking than I am. Okay. So, David, here's your imaginative challenge to process. Matt, we always
Yep.
do. David is given an imaginative challenge to run in parallel while we're trying to do all the discussion that we're about to do. It's part of my teaching methodology. And what he's got to do now is a joke. So every time there's something different, from really, soap opera challenges to critical analysis to whatever, this time he's got to do a joke. David, do you know the joke that ends with the punchline? The bear says, I don't think you really come up here to do hunting.
I don't think
It's
so.
funny just by itself, isn't it? Now that's an odd, see, this is what got me onto this. I did not know this joke. It features in the TV series Bosch and The Wire. I did not know this joke. I laugh at the punchline and I didn't even know what the joke was. And I thought, how can a punchline work on its own? But I think you will find a way to do this joke justice over the course of this conversation while we do other things, because you are the person with three brains,
Yeah,
That's
that's
how good.
true.
That's how
That's
good.
true. All right, cool. I
Right.
like it.
So we're good.
We're good. I
Now
just
we
I
can
have to
get
come
on
up
to
with a joke
Matt.
with that as a punchline. Yes, please do. I am very interested to hear this. I'll start off by saying, Matt, that my wife and I are currently very interested in becoming expats. We've looked at Honduras, Mexico. She's from Mexico originally. And so we've looked around that type of area. Also places like Portugal, Spain, Korea, Japan. Those are more cultural interest rather than financial, realistically, things that we can do. But I didn't want to step on any of Chris's questions, but I am hoping that we get to a little bit of that expat experience because
Yeah, I
it's
would
intriguing.
definitely not discourage it. I mean, Mexico is a wonderful place. I've lived here in El Salvador for about 6 years after growing up and living in the United States for many years. And it's just been an incredible change, just the change I needed. I've visited every country down here in Central America and a lot in the Caribbean and Mexico and South America. And it's just so many beautiful places down here too. Work remotely or retire or whatever your thing might be.
Retiring would be nice. It would be nice. It'd probably be more like remote work. But
Sure.
yeah, no, I just think that our issues here are purely financial. The cost of food has gone up 25% since 2020. The cost of rent is going up and it doesn't seem to be going down. Even though they're building new homes and supply is dwindling, it doesn't really seem like landlords are going to be in any rush to lower their extravagant rent prices. So it's mostly a cost of living thing. It just feels like life, you don't have to be super, super rich, but it would be nice to just make a decent income and not feel like you're always
No, it's,
swimming.
I mean, it's tough when I come back to the States, once or twice a year at least. And I'm from the Atlanta area. And last time I was back in Atlanta, I got a beer at the corner bar and it was like $12 for the beer. Down here in El Salvador, they have what they call a balde, a bucket of beer, like seven beers on ice for like $5, And I go back to Las Vegas, of course, on a regular basis. And Vegas, as Chris knows, used to be a very affordable place to live as far as major cities in the US go. And I go back there and, a hotel room that was $75 a few years ago is $125, $150, and everything that I tell people only half jokingly, I don't think I can afford to live in the US anymore, honestly.
It's because it's you've gotten used to the standard of living that you're in, or that it would be actually difficult to
Just
transition back to that.
No, just the price. Yeah, the price of living there, how expensive everything is, especially me having been an independent writer, editor, and teacher for much of my life, not having health insurance at times, in the US is extremely complicated. Where down here, they have good health care in El Salvador and it's very affordable. So I just pay, usually what I do down here is just pay out of pocket, and it's good. Good medical care, I would say at least on par with Las Vegas, which of course is not one of the better medical cities in the US, but and much more affordable. How Very
does
cool.
Yeah.
that work, Matt? I mean, that's interesting because I think healthcare is one of those, let's face it, after a certain age, healthcare becomes a little bit more of a concern than when we were 18. When I was 18, I thought I could fall off roofs and jump out of airplanes and nothing could harm me. How does that work there? Does that you make it sound easy?
You mean for an expat, me particularly, or for locals, or what? So, I came down here to work at a international school, Escuela Americana, the American school, and I worked there for 3 years as a teacher and ran the writing lab and sponsored the literary journal there. And I was on a work visa and I was getting insurance, international health insurance that would cover me in El Salvador and in the US and many other places. But after 3 years of, David, I believe you're a teacher, aren't you? A high school teacher. That's pretty much what I was doing down here, teaching world literature to 11th and 12th grade. There we go.
privileged Salvadorian kids, and
Yeah.
it was allowed to, put up the phone and, listen up
Oh my God,
and
don't get
that
me
kind of
started on the
stuff,
phone. Don't get
which,
me started on
yeah,
the
exactly. So after 3 years, it didn't feel like it would be a sustainable job for me for the next 10, 15 years. So I left the school, had some money saved. I looked into various insurance options. But to answer your question, Chris, currently what I'm doing is I have international insurance that covers me in El Salvador in the US, but it has a very high deductible, anywhere from like $2,500 to $5,000. I would have to cover that on my own, which is fine. That's not a problem. And then the insurance would kick in after that. So I don't know if that's a long-term solution or something I'm just doing for this year. Actually, that 1 year policy ends in the next month or two. So I'm gonna have to figure out if I want to re-up with that high deductible international health insurance, which I pay for, of course, out of my own pocket, or if I want to, what I've done many times over the years, and I'm sure Chris, you can relate, is just go without, and here it's more reasonable because I could actually, if something does come up medically here, I could cover it just paying out of pocket for it.
Does that
Yeah.
include things like
Okay.
cancer?
So, well, one question, I guess, is a deeper question. Are you now thinking of yourself kind of permanently as an expat? Because I really identify with, I think that's the flag I sail under. And I realized that once in a really strange situation in Hong Kong, which is not a city I've done a lot of time in, but I really, that was where the moment hit me. And I realized I was a permanent expat. I am a citizen of the Solomon Islands and Australia. Are you now an expat, and what does that mean to you? Yeah. Quickly, David, I did hear your question about does that health insurance cover cancer? And yeah, it covers most big things, most big situations like that. I'm sure there are quite a few gaps in that coverage, though.
Okay. Yeah. Chris's question is much more interesting.
It is a very interesting question that Chris was asking because it's more of a mentality than a physical state, isn't it, Chris? It's just and
It
you
is.
made me with your question, you've really made me think about how I am approaching that. And I still feel like a bit of an outsider here, which maybe is something I need to work on. But I do feel that, and I tell people this on a regular basis, I want to live down here for the next several years and the rest of my life, whether it's El Salvador or Guatemala or Mexico or Costa Rica. I'm really committed to this lifestyle. I love it. I've been down here more than 6 years now, and it's still new and different. In Vegas, going to the grocery store or going to the mall was a hassle, right? Here, everything, especially since I'm still learning the language, going to the mall is like an adventure. Going to the grocery store is too. So, I still feel like a foreigner in a lot of respects, but at the same time, I think I have taken to the lifestyle here and the life here, and I'm doing the best I can to live it.
Well, what I enjoyed, and for listeners, Matt was just here in Las Vegas, renewing his visa sort of status. And we had a wonderful connection. And it kind of reminded me of a bigger topic that I want to get to in a moment about the failure of writing and arts community connections and when things really do connect still. But one of the stories that he told, which I thought was really wonderful, and this is part of David and my larger project of talking about storytelling, is his relationship with a woman in El Salvador where the language barrier was a little bit sort of, a little bit thick.
And they had to work it through. And I think that's a lovely, lovely story. It really resonated with me. I have an estranged son via another world, another lifetime, and another culture that I just could not actually transcend. So I really admire anyone who can transcend that. But Matt, tell us a little bit about that moment, like your story when we were walking in the, just behind my house in the mountains. You were saying like it was kind of like being alone, trapped in a house, and you didn't actually have a common language, but you made it work out. And David can understand this because he has a very interesting partner himself from another culture. So, can you just share a little bit about that moment of trying to work that language thing out?
But you brought up another interesting thing, Chris, about I am currently on a tourist visa, which that used to mean every 3 months I would have to leave the country and come back, and then I would get 3 more months. And you couldn't just drive into Guatemala or Honduras or one of the neighboring countries. You had to go to Mexico or the US or Costa Rica. The president here, Nayib Bukele, he's been very tourist and remote worker friendly. And so they recently changed it where now on a tourist visa, you get 6 months at a time. You actually have people living here and in Costa Rica and other countries who have been on a tourist visa for 15, 20 years and just leaving on a regular
Oh,
basis and
yeah.
coming back. Yeah, it's
Oh,
really
yeah.
interesting. And
Okay.
now that it's every 6 months, that's about perfect for me. That's about how much I would travel by plane internationally anyway. So I do
Right.
want to become a resident here at some point, but right now I'm doing what a lot of people have done is living on a tourist visa 6 months at a time, taking a beautiful trip. It's a great excuse to go to Colombia or Costa Rica or back to Las Vegas, and then you come back and you get 6 more months. Now, to your original question, so after living in Vegas for 20 years, I moved to San Salvador to teach at the American School. And about 6 months into my tenure there, a friend of mine introduced me to a friend of hers named Aura Lee, a local woman, through Facebook. She connected us through a friend request, and I accepted it. And Aura Lee, my friend told me, speak some English, and she told Arvali that I spoke some Spanish. And but we were communicating through Messenger and using Google Translate. And then one day I get a call and I look at my phone and it's from Arvali Gramajo. And I'm like, oh, I guess Arvali speaks some English if she's calling me and wants to talk. So I pick up the phone and she's speaking to me in what sounds like really fast and very local and slangy Spanish, and I do not understand one word of what she said.
You
And
see David
I'm saying
smiling?
lo siento, no entiendo. I knew some basic Spanish at the time, but I had no idea what she was saying. I actually had to hang up the phone. It was embarrassing. I had to hang up the phone and message her using Google Translate and say, I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you were saying. You would have thought that would be maybe the end of the relationship, right? But no, like 6 years later, Arva Lee and I are living together. We're engaged. Her English has improved, but more recently, we put a focus on my Spanish, and I'm pretty much conversational now. So she speaks to me in Spanish, maybe a little bit slower than she would on the streets and with less slang. And I respond to her as much as I can in Spanish. And if I need to use some Spanglish, she understands English well enough that she can follow me.
Well, we need to let David cut in here because he has lived some time in El Paso. His woman is Hispanic Latina. He actually has some Spanish credentials, and he's also completely nuts. So that helps him. He's lived in Portland as well. So I think this is a really vital subject for all of North Americans. It's part of the Monroe Doctrine now, isn't it? Like how we relate to Central and South America. This is all coming good in the 21st century. So, David, hit it.
Well, I just really liked that story. I thought that was very cute, and it also very quickly makes me realize that all these dudes who feel like they're having trouble getting a girl, there's a whole cottage industry of these people, right? Who will teach you how, like, they're like life coaches, girl coaches. Listen to me, bro. I can get you a girlfriend, no problem. They all think that it's like what you got to, like, how you got to act and what you got to say. But Matt didn't speak Spanish at all and was still being pursued, meaning there's something else going on there that's not quite as easy as a one-to-one kind of peacock dance that we can do to attract a mate. But I do think that it's very interesting dealing with other cultures, because in my experience, spending as much time as I have around Mexican culture, it really loosened me up. I was wound up super, super tight, and my wife's family, and to be honest, most of the friends that I made in El Paso are so laid back, and they think it's really funny when you get wound up too. Like, if you start to worry about something, they pretty unanimously go like,
Round up white people, man.
what's your problem? You know, it is like, they'll say that. They'll be like, yep, you're definitely a white dude. You're getting all bent out
I
of shape
consider
over this.
myself pretty laid back for an American, but down here they think I'm pretty intense. And yeah, they'll either laugh at it or kind of look at me crazy, you know, like that crazy gringo, you know, something.
It's like, just why are you driving so fast? Where are you trying to get in a hurry? It's fun. It used to drive me crazy in El Paso, just, the slow drivers and people very slowly moving up to checkout lines and slowly checking out groceries. Which reminds me of a meditation that I heard of recently, in which you attempt to do all of your normal daily tasks, but as slowly as you possibly can. I did that the other day. It's a trip. You start tripping pretty quickly, because if you're making coffee, but you're slowly pouring coffee and you're slowly pouring the water in. I was late for work, but it was worth it for sure. But no. So I just think that that's a really cool and interesting way for a relationship to start. And the fact that it's still going, congratulations on being engaged, by the way.
Thank you.
It's just, of course, is just proof that there's something else. But then I guess that begs the question of what that other thing is. You guys were communicating through Google Translate. Couldn't have been ideal, but something clicked. What do you think happened?
So yeah, we used her English was ahead of my Spanish when we first met. You know, the typical school down here, you'll get at least 3 or 4 years of English, you know, at some point, grade school, middle school, or high school. So her English was ahead of my Spanish at first. And so we were communicating mostly in English, some Spanish, and then using our phones a lot. But I think I shared this story with Chris when we went hiking when I was back in Vegas. It's about a year, year and a half into us dating, and we had been using our phones a lot. And Arlie and I took a trip to Cuba, Havana, Cuba. You know, it seemed like a great place to visit. We had heard it's a very unique travel experience because they had been blocked off from the rest of the world for so much. There wasn't much other culture there. You know, there wasn't the big American influence you might see in other places in Central America and the Caribbean. And so we get to Cuba, which is notorious for having bad internet, but we had a nice Airbnb in the old historic area. And we figured the Wi-Fi would be okay there. So we get into the Airbnb and we're trying to use our phones, and the internet would not work. It was not working. And we just looked at each other like we were like, oh shit. And we were forced to put down our phones, you know, and actually try a little bit more to communicate in English and Spanish or Spanglish. And that trip turned out to be a breakthrough for us because we put down our phones for 4 or 5 days, and we never really picked them back up in the relationship.
Wow, so you
I
just let
love
it
that story,
vibe.
man. I love
That's
that
so cool.
story. I think that is a message for us all across all ages. I really think that is a huge, huge insight into the nature of human communication. That just
resonates no matter what age you are, really. I really do think that. I love that. Love that story. And I'm
Yeah,
so.
we always hear about how important communication is in a relationship, and it's true, but what I discovered is that when you speak the same language as someone, you use the words in a lot of different ways. A lot of times you might use it to not be fully honest, to mislead or even lie. When you're communicating, I feel on a higher level than just words, like Arlie and I were more through motion. Feelings, expressions, it felt more authentic in a lot of ways than just having a conversation with someone. It's tough to explain, and but it's just a feeling, a sensation that I've had.
I think
Oh,
that's
yeah.
really cool. Matt, I'd like to return to the subject of your major book, Beneath the Neon, and the question of homelessness, drug addiction, and mental illness in America. I think this is something that David and I have really looked pretty deeply into. What are your thoughts here about this? I mean, what's happening? What can we do? We know it's a crisis out of control in certain cities. I think I personally think there are two cities that are very important to me, San Francisco and Seattle, where I think the plot has been lost. I don't think we're getting it back. I think Los Angeles, because it's Los Angeles County, is big enough to maybe control what is obviously a real just, I mean, it's just out of control, really. But I think it's big enough to control it. Whereas some of these other smaller cities, and maybe perhaps Portland would also be in here. What are your thoughts on what's happening with this segment
Yeah.
of fallen through the cracks people?
So you had mentioned my first book, Beneath the Neon, which is about homelessness, but mainly in the sense of me taking a flashlight, a tape recorder, and an expandable baton for self-defense and exploring the underground flood channels beneath Las Vegas. And I discovered a homeless population living down in these tunnels, because as you know, Chris, Vegas doesn't get much rain, so the flood channels are dry most of the year and much cooler, much safer, ironically, in a lot of ways, and you're kind of out of sight, out of mind. And I did interview the homeless people who live down there, but my latest book, Dark Days, Bright Nights, is an oral account of surviving the Las Vegas storm drain. So I interviewed about 35 people who made it out of the Las Vegas storm drains and got off the drugs and reunited with family and found jobs. But I didn't just focus on their years in the tunnels. The first question I asked them all is, what was your earliest memory? And then I kind of worked
Ooh.
through their childhood and them ending
Wow.
up in Las Vegas, living in the tunnels, because most coverage of homelessness that I've seen is right when the person is homeless, they're being interviewed, or right when they're in recovery. We don't see the full scope of the issue and the problem. So I wanted to show it from its earliest roots all the way through recovery to show that it is possible. We hear a lot from politicians and others, these people want to be homeless, and my book alone, I think, is proof that's not true. These people do want help. They do want change. They just need the right opportunity at the right time.
Do you think of yourself as a folklorist, anthropologist?
It's funny you mention anthropology, sociology. I noticed in bookstores a lot, Beneath the Neon is shelved in like sociology or anthropology and stuff like that. I've never really looked at it that way. I'm, a writer, a journalist, a bit of an activist. I did go into the tunnels for the story, but I came out the other end of the tunnel really wanting to help these people who had let me into their homes and let me interview them and shared these really intimate details with me. Chris, I think I started a community project called Shine a Light to help the homeless people who are living in the tunnels. I wanted the book to come out and get media coverage and that the city or a nonprofit would do something to help the people down there, but that didn't really happen. So a few years after the book came out, I founded Shine a Light as a community project to help the people get out of the tunnels. And it's now a big nonprofit that's helping like hundreds of people a week. So no, I see myself as a writer with an activist bent to it more than I think a folklorist and an anthropologist, but maybe I'm not understanding the connection there.
Well, I think whatever you understand is good, you know. And I want to support that, and want to support that with my own music interests of playing with people who are on the street who do have obvious mental health issues. I have a problem playing with people who are obviously on drugs, you know. I just don't like that. But who knows, you know? But we're getting more and more people who have an interest in music and can actually show up to a gig. That's kind of one of the tests of people, I think, is can you show up on time? You know, it's a little bit, it's personal hygiene and it's showing up on time. If you could do those, you're not really that fucked up, you know? I mean, that's a starting point for what we can work with. So I wanted to work more with you on this. I think you've explored something really interesting in a very strange American city that I think has many great things going for it in terms of integration racially and culturally, and also has some many things that are just terribly failing. So I'm really looking forward to more discussion about that. How does being in El Salvador, because you're now at, you know, a little bit of a latitude difference, well, a significant latitude difference, how does that connect you to Las Vegas?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, so after 20 years in Vegas, and I know you can relate, Chris, it felt like too much, you know. It was just such the kind of stereotypical roller coaster of life in Las Vegas, the ups and downs, and it just became laughable at some point. So, I mean, not that I was homeless or drug addicted or suicidal my last few years in Vegas, but it was just like so many signals saying, dude, it's time to go try something else, you know. And I finally picked up on those clues and moved down here. And after 20 years in Vegas, San Salvador was the perfect antidote to those years, because in a lot of ways, it's the exact opposite, the polar opposite of Las Vegas. I mean, Las Vegas is a night town, right? It's in a desert. People come out at night. In San Salvador, yeah, there is some nightlife here, but the area where I live, everything shuts down at 8 p.m., 8:30, 9 o'clock. Vegas and Nevada is very individualistic, in my experience, very libertarian, very every person for themselves. Here, it's all about the family. You know, my girlfriend, Aurelie, she works with her family. She sees them every day. She helps take care of her niece. You know, they work together and celebrate together. And that ties into homelessness too. You don't see many homeless people here, because even if it's in a lean-to tin shack with no running water and no electricity, you have a place to go. You have family that misses you
right.
and wants you there under any
right.
circumstances. And really, I could go on and on about the differences between the two places. But San Salvador, unbeknownst to me 6.5 years ago, was exactly what I needed after 20 years in Las Vegas.
That is so interesting. And I wonder, because you did mention yelling at kids to get off phones, solidarity on that, by the way. And I...
Mr. Osborne.
Yeah, Mr. Osborne. I can't help but wonder then, because, you know, the reasons given for the American dissolution of the familial unit and this kind of balkanization of people into increasingly small subcategories and niches is largely blamed on phones. But what I'm hearing is that in El Salvador, in San Salvador, phones can exist still with this familial unit. So to what from your position as an outsider, do you attribute the strength of these familial bonds?
Well, you had mentioned cell phones, and of course, they have a lot of the same technology here in El Salvador that we have in the States. But just kind of, it reminds me a lot, El Salvador now, of the US in like the 70s and 80s. And I mean that as a compliment, that it just feels very quaint. Like the malls are still popular here. People still actually, families and friends gather at the malls. You know, they're very lively and energetic. Technology is maybe not 30, 40 years behind the US, but you know, 15, 20, it's just not as important here. So that's a big part of it. But really with the family unit, a lot of it's economical. And I've tried to explain this to my girlfriend. In the US, you can get a job in, whether you're a man or a woman, right? You can get a job and support
Oh,
yourself.
yes.
And that buys you independence. We don't really think about it in that perspective, but that's what it does. Here, the average person in El Salvador is a street vendor. The people here are very resourceful. They'll have an extra room in a house and they'll turn it into a little tienda, a little, you know, mini mart, and sell stuff out of it. And, you know, it's incredible. But the average person here makes $300 to $400 a month. You know, that's
right.
And so, I mean, that puts things in perspective. So you can't afford your independence. You're in a lot of ways forced to work together as a family unit to live, to pay bills, to get by. And I'm not saying that's why they do it exclusively, but I think it plays a part in it. The American independence and the closeness, the tight-knit families that are here.
Right. Very interesting. Chris, you'd mentioned some story. We've been talking a lot about how everybody understands the term storytelling, but we don't hear very much about story listening. And Chris had mentioned that he had some questions about that. And I'm anxious to get to them because I've been thinking about story listening for the past week. Not to rapidly switch subjects on you guys. I just go wherever my
Well, I think
gold,
Matt got
goldfish
to a
brain
little
takes
bit
me.
Of it with the lady friend moment of being, you know, kind of in a claustrophobic space, trying to deal with a relationship building exercise without the help of the internet. But I wonder, when I was an expat, and I really identify with this very, very deeply, as a kind of permanent sort of spiritual condition. I think it's stamped on my passport, my passport for life. And I don't really know if I agreed to that necessarily. I guess I did. But the listening idea seems to me so much more necessary when one is in a foreign country, not at home. And you have to not just listen to words. You have to listen to body language. You have to listen to tonality. You have to listen to what perhaps might be the real intention of people. I mean, does someone mean to beat the shit out of you? Or do they mean to, like, really, like, they're just being friendly?
And, it's a good skill to have in the tunnels of Las Vegas as well, I'm sure.
Well, I think this is one of the great life skills. I think that we've got to know tonality first. We've got to understand intention. We've got to understand what someone does not mean almost before what they mean. Does that make any sense to you, Matt?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I'm still digesting this story listening term. I like it. I don't know if I understand it entirely, but on the topic of listening, I do think that's one of my strengths as a writer and a journalist. I've never claimed to be a deep thinker or a great thinker as a writer, as a lot of people are. But one thing I enjoy is listening to people in the tunnels. That's what I did, right? I listened to the people, their stories. No one really cared about my story so much at that point when you encounter a homeless Vietnam vet who's addicted to crack cocaine living right underneath Caesar's Palace, right? Whoa, how did this guy get here? And I was genuinely curious about that. And with my latest book, Dark Days, Bright Nights, same thing. I was, I interviewed these people and they shared their stories with me. And that book, I was more of a listener and an editor, even though I wrote an intro and set up each chapter with a little introduction as well. That was really about listening and in editing, and it's something you always hear, right? You don't learn when you're talking, you learn when you're listening. And I believe in that to a certain extent.
How would you approach the subject of teaching curiosity to, 18 to 21 year olds today? Because this is what you are. You're natively curious, as David and I are. I mean, we can't help ourselves.
Yeah.
We cannot help ourselves be good listeners, because we are. And because we're really just curious about life and the universe. What would your advice be to 18 to 21 year olds in, and the context I'm talking about, a major state university, very diverse. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I don't have any particular exercise in mind. I would be curious to hear how you approach that in class, Chris. But I do just think curiosity in general is so important. It's benefited me well. And just when I'm traveling, like we go to San Jose, Costa Rica, Aureli and I, and we get out and explore the town. We go to the museums and we talk to the locals and eat at the local restaurants. And just being a writer and a person who wants to grow and learn, I just think curiosity is so important to that. But Chris, I'm genuinely interested in your approach to it in the classroom and what you might
You know
do.
what I do? I really believe in Las Vegas is the city of magicians, and get there first. And I know where people are going to sit. My classrooms are not big enough to accommodate the people that I have, so I know where they're all going to sit. And you can wire a seat so that there's a little bit of a jump, and when you do that, people go, wow, you're a magician. And I go, yeah, well, sit down over there. No, they won't. They'll stand up because they know they're going to get a little shock, and I think to myself, the Las Vegas tradition and the world tradition of magic is a really good idea. Always surprise people. Always be there before them. Always be there before them.
Yeah,
Very easy to do.
I think that overdoing 189 episodes with Chris
For an hour or two.
I do think that that kind of non sequitur roundabout way of engaging curiosity is interesting. I still haven't found a way exactly because I'm not brave enough to integrate it into my English class quite yet, but I've learned a lot about how to, well, I guess I sort of do. Occasionally, I will just throw random non sequitur thoughts at students, and you can see it just kind of wakes them up. I'm like, do you ever think about the fact that, the earth was created, I don't know, 6 billion years ago or whatever it is, right? And they think, well, what does this have to do with the yellow wallpaper? And I'm like, nothing. Just throw that out there. So I think that what's our biggest challenges, though, when it comes to curiosity is again the phones, because there's one thing that kills curiosity. It's the ability to scroll and instantly see something that you find mildly interesting. Before I forget, though, what is your earliest memory?
Oh, wow. My earliest memory. Yeah, the table's being turned on me here for sure. And to be perfectly honest, I know I was probably around 2 or 3 years old. And I was born in Washington, D.C., but we moved to the
Me
Atlanta
too.
area because, yeah, my father got a job teaching English at Georgia Tech. And we were living in the suburbs of Atlanta in an apartment. And I remember he and my mom getting into a pretty heavy argument. Really, I was
Really? That's your first memory?
3 years old. Yeah. And it's
Damn.
so unfair because it might be the only time that the two of them had this kind of, I've never been married, but I imagine it was one of those, I'm working full time as a professor. I have two young kids. This is stressful. This is tough. Kind of tension going on, and there were no one got hurt physically, but it was like some doors slammed, and it was pretty shocking for a young man. And it's weird that I have to share that as my first memory, but it's true. But
Hey,
my
good
parents have
on
been
you, man.
together
Good on you.
for more than 50 years. I've never seen them. Yeah, they have their disagreements, or whatever, but I've never seen them fight like that since that particular day. I'm
Wow.
pretty sure I'm not imagining that or dreaming that because I remember my older sister mentioning that too, remembering that. She's about 3 or 4 years older than me. But you bring up a good point because that question I asked the people who used to live in the tunnels, maybe it's not fair. Maybe it's not really indicative of their life at large. In my case, I don't think it was, but.
Yeah.
Well,
Well, what
maybe.
is emblematic, what is emblematic of ourselves? This is something Dave and I talk about a lot. That's a really difficult question. You we don't want to sort of succumb to that, and we don't want to also just sneak out behind it either.
I have a really creepy memory, my first memory. At my grandmother's house, she would collect these Harlequin dolls. And I remember she had a basement where a tenant lived named Bobby. And I would look down the stairs, and it was very Lynchian, the way that the light started up here, and then it got dark as soon as you got down into the bottom of the staircase. And there were these Harlequin dolls that lined the walls. And I just remember that. So maybe all of our first memories are terrifying. Because you're figuring out the world and everything is scary, and your brain just eventually finds something that's scary enough to decide that you're ready to start remembering things.
But I think some of the answers in my book, Dark Days, Bright Nights, to that earliest memory question were revealing. They did turn out to be that way. I remember Eazy-E, that was his street name, mentioned his first memory was being in an adoption agency and meeting his new parents, and then Cindy. Her first memory was she was supposed to be watching her little brother in their bedroom. He was up top on a bunk bed. She was down below. Her first memory was him falling off that bed and breaking his neck and dying. And
Holy shit.
her parents blaming her and her blaming herself because she was supposed to be watching this kid. And that kind of goes back to what Chris had said about the homeless problem in the US and living in Central America and coming back to Atlanta and Las Vegas and other places, you really notice how much the problem has grown over the past year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And a lot of people in the book had talked about this. You guys probably know a little bit about this early childhood trauma. If you go through this big event like Cindy went through, how that stays with you in life and can really affect the rest of your life, possibly leading to drugs and alcohol, which may lead to homelessness, but it's a complicated issue for sure.
I do
Yes, it
wonder.
is.
I do wonder, did you get any first memories that were overwhelmingly positive, where there was a kind of incongruence between, like, my first memory was of eating ice cream with my dad, and then they end up living in a tunnel?
Exactly. Yeah, there was some of that. Yeah, and I don't want to suggest that all homeless people, had a traumatic childhood. It's not like that. Some did mention kind of what you were getting at, David, like my first birthday at a McDonald's playground and all my friends and family there and everything going well, that type thing. So yeah, there was quite a variety in the answers there. I haven't looked at that book in a while or that particular opening chapter, but there was a fair mix of responses in there.
Awesome. Awesome. That's really cool. Yeah, because I find this kind of thing fascinating, especially because when you do get people who have those traumatic, like Cindy, the broken neck brother situation, you do wonder if like how they might get past something like that, or at least integrate it. There might not ever be getting past certain things, but how to integrate it in a healthy way rather than in a living in a tunnel type way, which does also lead me to my next question. How many people did you meet who just kind of wanted to live in a tunnel? Like seriously, like who just thought I prefer this for whatever reason. No
A
real.
few, I mean, very few people would admit that openly to me, but a few did, who are like, some of them had the attitude, hey, this ain't that bad. You know, I have a roof, two walls, you know, I have a mattress that I found in a dumpster that's down here, and I have my privacy. And one of them, I remember, Trucker Mike, he had been a Vietnam vet and a trucker for many years, and he had
I
a view.
remember him, yeah.
Yeah, he had a view of the strip of like Mandalay Bay and the Luxor from his tunnel. He lived right at the outlet, and he said, you know, I got a $1,200 a month
That's a
view
great
here for
pace.
free, you know, and he had that kind of attitude about it. And some of them do, but the large majority of them are like, hey man, this is a temporary situation. They're embarrassed about, you know, where they are in life at that point, you know, and they do want to get out of it, or at least they say that and express that, you know.
Are there any that aren't addicted to drugs?
Very, very few. You know, some alcoholics, of course. The three main drugs in Las Vegas in the tunnels were, you know, crack cocaine, heroin, and meth. So the majority of them were addicted to one of those. Alcohol and of course gambling in Las Vegas. You know,
Gambling,
a
yeah.
lot of the people I interviewed down there said gambling's the worst addiction of all of them, because the casino, the machine is available 24/7, where the drug man, the dealer, he has to sleep. He's not always available like these machines are. So a lot of them would make the point that gambling is their worst addiction and is one of the main reasons they're down there.
That's so interesting. I remember the first time that my wife and I visited Las Vegas. We got off the plane and we saw the slot machines in the airport, and we looked at each other and said, "Oh, this is different. This is a different place. This is a very different place." Also, we went to Vegas recently for a concert, a big show, and I started to realize that I mean, this is everywhere in America to some extent, but in Vegas, it's more pronounced. So you see it. It just does really feel like a place that is designed to separate you from every dollar you have at every turn. Luckily, there was free parking at our hotel, but I do like the city, but man, you gotta come to ball, dude, because you can't be going there to, just kind of hang out and sightsee and bird watch. You gotta be ready to, if you ain't winning money, you losing money.
And
So
Dave, just to back up a minute. So yeah, I would say 90 to 95% are addicted to one drug or another down there, but I would not say that's why they are in the tunnels. You know, people would say, oh, they're drug addicts, that's why they're in the tunnels. No, it's a lot more complicated than that, and it's more closely connected to the trauma that I had talked about before, which led to them using drugs to try to drown out that past, which led them to becoming homeless and living in the tunnels. I just wanted to clarify that
No,
point.
that makes total sense. Yeah, that makes total sense. It definitely, I wonder about, there's a book called The Body Keeps the Score, and it talks about generational trauma. Somebody did a study with rats where they found out that if you really scare a mother rat or like a grandmother rat and torture that rat, its children's children will be skittish in the exact same way that the, so it's this idea of this transference of genes down. And the idea is that people hold trauma in their bodies in a similar way, not just in their minds, but in their stomach, their heart, their liver. And when I think about the people who, the few people maybe who you found who just seem to kind of enjoy living in the tunnel, or perhaps had the, you know, the birthday party memories, or, you know, just didn't have anything bad necessarily that bad happened to them. I wonder if it's not a kind of generational trauma type thing. They talk about this with Holocaust survivors too. Like the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors still having remnants of that trauma built into their DNA. But it's interesting to think about that as a locus point of all the of the homeless problem, basically. And then it becomes strange to think about how the homeless problem is then growing, which means an increase in trauma. It's wild.
Well, I just want to chime in here and say, although Matt is reluctant to label himself as a very fine folklorist and anthropologist, I think he achieves that on every level. And I think that Beneath the Neon and the latest book, which is kind of a reprise of this, is something to look for, to. And also, there's a wonderful book about a really funky motel in Las Vegas, which is kind of the Tropicana equivalent of the great Tom Waits era. My Blue Angel, which is on Charleston, I believe. And I think that there's some really funky, interesting things going on there. And one of the things that I really appreciate so much is that Matt is really engaged with Las Vegas culture across many, many levels. And, when I came back to the States, I had this wonderful fellowship at the Black Mountain Institute, and I was wined and dined by all these people, and everyone was so superficially friendly. And yet, none of them actually wanted to be here in Las Vegas. They didn't enjoy the culture, they didn't enjoy the anthropology. And I think Matt O'Brien really has done that. He's really dug in deep and gone underground. And I even though he's moved to Central America, I think that sense of connection with some of the really deep issues of our time, homelessness, mental illness, drug addiction, the nexus, there in. There's a lot of really, really wonderful things. And I encourage you to pursue his books. We'll post some links about his work. But thank you, Matt, for joining us. I mean, I was really so grateful to see you out in Vegas here. It was really fun. It's one of those things where I realized, God damn it. Writers and artists used to be fun people, and I really enjoyed our time together. And David and I have talked about this. This was kind of the beginning of our whole webcast. This whole thing was that we just felt kind of a little bit lonely, and a little bit angry too about what happened to the arts community. And I was really grateful for seeing you again and just having some fun locally. I mean, God damn it, that weird night.
That was
How
weird.
am I
That
here?
was a great time. I love your house and the area where you live. It's special. I think if I miss anything, David and Chris, about Vegas, it's that the outdoors, the surrounding part, not the strip or downtown or the people necessarily, no offense meant, but like Vegas, the Greenfield jungle, right? You need to get away from it and sit and meditate on a red rock to find that balance, right? And I miss just being able to go out with by myself or with a girlfriend and get lost in nature. And we were able to do a little bit of that where you live. It's a beautiful place. But just to back up 1 minute, you had mentioned my second book, My Week at the Blue Angel. It's a collection of nonfiction stories. And for the title story, I checked into the Blue Angel Motel, which was the seediest and kind of scariest weekly motel in Las Vegas,
Charleston Avenue,
which
yeah.
is saying something. Yeah, at the end of Fremont Street at Charleston, and you know, a weekly motel, $100 for the week. You slide it under the plexiglass window to a burned out looking figure back there. And anthropology, Chris, you know, I stayed there for a week, and it took me a few days to get the courage to start interviewing other people in the other rooms. But man, you talk about some interesting people. And everyone has a Blue Angel story, regardless of what structure you are in Vegas. If you're a casino CEO or a homeless person, you have a Blue Angel story of some sort or another. So maybe that's the kind of anthropology that you were getting at earlier.
Is it okay
Yeah,
if it,
I
can
think when you come back, we've got to do a Siegel Suites thing.
I
I ask you a couple
taking over the
lightning round?
world, man. Siegel Suites, watch out.
Can I ask you just some quick lightning round questions? I'm very curious.
Yeah.
Just real quick. What do you think about during the day? What's the thing that you think about the most?
What do I think about during the day? Wow. I try not to think too much at the daytime. You know, the daytime, I'm pretty regimented. I have a schedule. Like right now, this year, my goal is to write for at least an hour in the morning. I'm working on a collection of stories set on the streets of Las Vegas, similar to my nonfiction work, but fiction, vignettes,
Cool.
flash in short stories, you know, related to homelessness, the tunnels, the weekly motels. So I try to get up and write at least an hour, and then I have to quickly shift to my editing work. I have an editing service, O'Brien Editing Services, where I edit books and websites, short stories, academic papers. And then, you know, it's lunchtime. I'm eating here. I work in the home. I have a beautiful, I wish you guys could see it. It's nighttime now, but my office has a view of the active volcano, the San Salvador volcano, which
Yeah,
luckily has not,
it's lovely,
yeah, it
man.
has
It's
not gone,
lovely.
not erupted in about 100 years. But if it does, I'll be one of the first to know whether that's a good or
No, that's a
bad
lovely
thing.
view.
But
It's a
yeah, and
lovely.
it's fun to kind of work with that view. The volcano keeps me honest, keeps me on my toes. I don't want to anger it, you know. So, and then, you know, I'm in this kind of siesta thing, like in Spain, where after lunch you might
Yeah.
find the couch, read a little bit, fall asleep, and then get back up and work a few more hours. You know, and then play basketball. I try to stay in shape, and it's usually at night when I do my thinking, you know, in bed with my girlfriend, grateful for a lot of things and thinking about, you know, stuff. Usually the next, no deep thoughts, usually about what I'm going to do the next day or the next week or goals and stuff like that. So
That is the coolest shit I've ever heard. I love that answer. That's really awesome. I'm trying to get to the point where you're at. Yeah, I'm definitely trying to get that regimented attitude towards my day and think less about things. One more question and then I'll be done.
Well, just to add to that, yeah. So my goal, I try to write every day creatively, you know, and I try to edit every day professionally, and then I try to read. I'm not talking about my Facebook feed, but I mean a good work of literature. So Chris, I'm sure Chris can relate to that. But yeah, you know, write creatively, edit, and then read, you know, are three of my goals every day. And I'm fortunate, you know, to not have kids and have some money to be fairly comfortable, and I can live like that. In El Salvador, you know, that would be a lot tougher
It'd
to
be a
do
different story.
remote work if your land
No,
was somewhere else,
totally.
honestly.
Totally. How do you feel about people in general? Mostly positive or mostly negative?
Well, I'm a lot more positive about people now living here than I was 7 or 8 years ago in Las Vegas. I'll tell you that. And I'm not trying to take cheap shots. I have a lot of dear friends in Las Vegas, but my God, David and Chris, the people down here are so fucking warm and friendly and loving, beautiful inside and out, no ulterior motives, just like, you know, just wonderful people. So, It's a timely question, but yeah, it was a good time for you to ask that because I have a more positive response than I might have had at times in the past.
That's
That's
so
so
awesome.
cool.
Yeah,
That is so cool.
it was
I
very
cannot
cool to meet you.
say that here. And I think that really, Matt, good for you. You found that. You've worked hard to find that. And also, destiny has led you to that. But nonetheless, that's so wonderful. I mean, that's a huge thing to be able to say.
Hey, one quick word, speaking about books and being an expat and traveling. I'm curious if you guys, I have a book recommendation for you. Have you guys
Ooh.
heard of Alan Weisbecker? It's a
No, I
writer
have
and a
not.
speaker. He passed away just a few months ago in his mid-70s. He's from Long Island, New York, was a surfer, was a drug runner and a drug user. He was one of the early writers on Miami Vice. He fictionalized some of his real life drug running experiences and stories. But when he was about 50 years old, he bought an RV with his dog and he drove down the coast of Mexico, like from the San Diego area down that way, and surfed the beaches of Mexico. He came all the way through Guatemala, El Salvador, but he was looking for a long lost friend of his, an old surfer buddy named Christopher, who had disappeared in Central America. And it's just a beautiful travel memoir. It's a lot about surfing. Some of the most, I mean, one of the greatest sports books I've read in the sense of describing a
A
sporting
cool
activity physically
recommendation.
and mentally. Yeah, and it's Searching for Cap In Search of Captain Zero is the title by Alan Weisbecker,
I
and
actually
he's a
own
brilliant
I
writer.
own
I can't
Cosmic
believe
Bond
I had not
Bandidos.
heard of him. I was Googling, and came across a list of the best books for expats to read who live in Mexico or Central America, and this was somewhere on the list, and it was the one that I was like, oh, this sounds interesting. And when I was in Vegas, Chris, recently, I picked up a hard copy of it, brought it back, and it was the first book I read when I got back, and it's incredible. In Search of Captain
Oh,
Zero by
well,
Alan
thank you for
Weisbecker.
that, Matt. Osborne will be all over that. He's our man in those territories. But this is what we're trying to build, these kind of recommendations. I think this is what great teaching is about, is sharing things that are meaningful to you, sharing books that
Chris,
are.
you would appreciate this book too, The Thinking. He's a brilliant thinker, and he's able to express that thinking on the page in a very poetic way.
Well, I dig that. I think that sounds like a must read, right?
But have you guys ever had that feeling? You read a great book, you feel like you're dear friends with the author, and then when you finish it, you want to reach out to this person. And I found out he had died just a few months ago, and I guess in October. And that was a bit crushing because actually now you can reach out to authors and kind of connect and communicate with them. And I kind of envisioned us having a beer, at the beach here, La Libertad in El Salvador, and having a beer and a great conversation. It was not to be, but
That person for me was actually Chris.
yeah.
Chris was that dude. Yeah, when I was 18, which is forever ago now, 20 years ago now, I had been a big fan of Chris's books. I had Zanesville and Private Midnight, and then I ended up meeting him at a convention, and he took me to Vegas, and we harassed a mini Mr. T on the strip, and it was just instant friends ever since.
Wonderful.
Yep.
David is good with dwarfs. Really
Guys,
good
I
with
really,
dwarfs.
Chris, thanks so much for having me on. It was great to see you recently. And David, pleasure to
Nice to
meet
meet
you
you.
and to speak to you.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. You're doing some really cool things. Be well, be safe. It was really great to see you here. I appreciate you taking the time to make my visit a little bit part of your journey. But you're always welcome here on the show. David and I are building from strength to strength. We're heading to 200 episodes. We're building a big thing. So
You're
always a friend here, okay?
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Let's keep in touch, guys.
Peace.
Adios. Buenas noches.
Mr. Osborne, do you have your joke?
Yeah, you want to hear it?
I do,
Here it
because I know
goes.
you're my favorite genius.
All right. A man loses his wife to cancer.
Ooh, this is already a good start. This is just so good. All the
He
Jewish people.
watches as she slowly wastes away into nothing. On the day that she dies, the man is asleep in the chair next to her bed, and he is visited in his dream by Shiva, and he witnesses worlds being created and destroyed, paralleling his own feelings of his world ending. He is given a magic totem by a lesser demon, a gnarled witch's finger that will give him the ability to renew his feelings of pain whenever he becomes complacent in his life. He commits to live it to the fullest. He gets a job and begins to pick up the pieces of his life. He gets a job at a Safeway, checking groceries and smiling at customers. He befriends the bagger, a man with Down syndrome named Buck, who's the black sheep of a family of biker gangs trafficking methamphetamine. During a particularly boring shift, punctuated by a man threatening to kill him over a mispriced cheesecake, the witch's finger twitches and he once again feels that pain. The man asks Buck if he can introduce him to his biker family. Over the next 10 years, with nothing to live for, the man becomes the most brutal drug trafficker in the United States, leaving a trail of dead bodies and broken homes. The man now sits on the throne of the Sick Puppies United Biker Club, big beard tattoos the works, and he becomes complacent in his success. And again, he feels that pain. This time, the universe intervenes. You can't cut a path of destruction that violent without there being consequences. Four Latin kings slaughter his people and kidnap him, throwing him in the trunk of a car and driving him out to the woods of Colorado to finally put him down. They didn't know that he was double-jointed. He gets out of the handcuffs and John Wicks the kings to death, the car spiraling out of control and hitting a tree. He's flung from the car and tumbles end over end, coming to a bloody and broken stop in a clearing 50 yards away. He feels the life draining from him, and he sees his wife coming toward him over the clearing. And he feels at peace. That feeling of peace triggers the witch's finger, which begins to dig through his pocket and emerge through his zipper. A grizzly bear and her three cubs wander into the clearing and go to investigate the dying man. The bear notices the witch's finger sticking out of his zipper and says, "I don't think you came here to go hunting."
Oh dear. Oh dear. What are we gonna do with you? You are my absolute favorite genius of all time. I'm sorry to say that to other people, but it's just the way it is. Oh dear. Oh dear. I had to loosen my pants a little bit there. Oh gosh, that's very funny. Well done.
Thank you,
Well done.
sir. Do you have
If
a
you
tool and
can't
a
do a
tip for us today?
joke, you maybe should rethink your whole creative enterprise for people who are trying to be creative writers. It is about study stand-up comedy, be respectful of that great art, learn some vaudeville, get out there in front of like some extended jokes, some simple gags. Know what's going on with that form, because if you understand what that form is doing, you will be ahead of AI. This is one of the major things that AI cannot do. They cannot, it just can't do humor. But follow this discipline of engaging with creative challenges and rising to the challenge. Rising to a challenge is really like, it's like getting wet, getting an erection. It's like it is competitive. It is something, serious. And it is important that creative people are thinking in these terms, that we need to get with what humans can do that AI can't do. I'm going to be pursuing this in future episodes of the day, but I'm very, very worried about what AI is about to do. I think it could be the biggest challenge that humanity has ever faced. So we've got to celebrate what is really good about humanity. And on that note, I'm ready to go to my tool and tip.
All right, let's do it.
We often think that there are structural limitations defining our lives. Are there really? I was thinking about this the other day. I have a beautiful, big bathtub for the women in my life in the master bedroom. The champagne thing, the bubbles, but it takes a lot of water. And I don't really feel good about doing that when I'm on my own, Whereas the bathroom in my guest bathroom, if I wanted to take a bath to sort of just loosen my back up or, I don't know, do a little prostate sort of thing or whatever, it's too small. It's structurally too small. It's uncomfortable. I can't get deep enough into the hot water on a cold morning without the water lapping up over the side. Now, that is a real structural issue. So I've inventoried that because I think we have a lot of ideas about structural things that are impairing our performance, our enjoyment, our love, or whatever, and they're not real. This is just very real. It's just too small a fucking bathtub. I could go to the other bathtub and it's too big. I think if we look really closely at what the structural, architectural, physical things defining our lives are and really get ruthless with that inventory, we will see that we often assign to life a lot of things that are not really real. I think we need to get back to the bathtub that's just too fucking small. Get to that and then go with, well, maybe go to the bathtub that's too big, But if you inventory things that are really architectural and physical in your life, you start to think about the choices you're actually making, the things that you can decide, the choices that you define, And I think that's a really important tool. And my tip is based on this idea. I've really embraced dictation. I did 2,800 words just on my phone, and it took me 22 minutes to proofread that and edit that. And I think they're pretty good. I mean, I'm not going to say I'm going to keep them. I'm not going to say that. But I think that's a pretty good little effort for someone just, looking into this. But I think that what we need, all creative people need different modes of recording, just as we need different notebooks. I've got very different notebooks. I'm sure you do. I think a lot of our listeners do. I think we need different ways to engage. It's like just have some different protocols for connecting with certain, ideas. And the ideas then will structure themselves. I think that's really important, Let ideas try to structure themselves. Ideas want to structure themselves. I think this is a really hard thing for us to realize is that we are not the captains of the ideas. We are not. They're trying to find a way of expressing themselves. They're part of a giant world language tradition. They're part of, a great cultural tradition. I mean, I without any I did, no intent at all. I dictated a line out of Schopenhauer. I didn't really mean to do that. I'm not, copying. I thought, wait a minute, that sounds a little bit familiar. So I went back and Googled on it. But it's okay. Be part of a great cultural tradition, be part of a great discussion. And if you get it wrong, well, just keep talking, keep talking to your phone, keep proofreading. It's going to be all right,
That's awesome. How've the dreams been?
Well, I gotta say, they've been a little bit, I'm very concerned. I slipped into a nightmare world. And I'm a little bit, I am honestly very concerned about it. I haven't had what I would call nightmares for some time. I didn't well wake up in a huge panic attack, sweating or throwing thing, beating the girlfriend and all that kind of stuff. But it really made me very, I'm sure it raised my heart rate, I'll say that. And I wonder, the theme is going back to my time in Australia. Really difficult, verging on hideous, what I have to call white trash people. I think there's a real element of poverty and deformity and, monstrousness coming out of a kind of a class situation. But a really ugliness and a deep evil that I just don't know in America. I just, I've been in the South. I mean, there are crazy people all over the fucking, part of Nevada, armed up with gun. I just never, I just don't worry about that. I walk around out in the middle of the fucking desert, and I never, ever worry about what I would call white trash people descending on me on, ATVs and weapons. And I just don't worry. I never have that problem. But I do in my dreams about Australia. And they're really ugly, deep dreams that, and in one of them, I don't know, a very rotund man in his late 40s said, "Gotta get my father a beer." And I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I it was like, don't know. It was really this evil deformity thing of not just impoverished white people who are mean. It was more psychotic and surreal and really, really deeply scary, And I just don't ever, I don't know, I don't feel that way. I didn't feel that way with the drug addicts that I left my last condo. Remember them? I wasn't scared of them. I know, I was like, no, fuck you, man. I left because I didn't want to live in the suburbs anymore. These people in the dreams, I think they're scary.
That is so you'll understand what I mean by this question, but if you encountered these people in the waking world, would you be as scared of them as you are in the dream? Or is it the dreamlike quality that exacerbates the fear?
That's a really good question, David. See, you are my favorite genius. I think it is the latter. I think that there's something that slips into the dream world that is a little bit more silken and loose, that makes the scare a little bit more real. No, I don't think I would be. No, I no, I absolutely now. When you ask me that, I think about it and go, no, they're not monsters. They're not like childhood monsters. They're just fuck it, you know,
Yeah.
really.
Yeah. And I think that's a real thing that the dream world does, is that those people who we see who we just dismiss as fuckheads, sometimes the way that dream can adequately introduce us to the full sheer terror of the spirit that possesses those people is by presenting them as they are within the dream milieu, where it's not supposed to be like that. Dreams are many things. Dreams aren't supposed to be like anything, but they're really not supposed to be like that. Just naked. I mean, even dreams don't want to be that way. You know what I mean? So to have that intrude, I think, is jarring. In the same way, when the dream world intrudes on reality, when reality intrudes on the dream world like that, but not even. I mean, mundane reality is what I'm talking about, you know? And I think that that can make it doubly scary. I think that what you were feeling in those dreams, like the terror that's incongruent with the imagery, is that you're being exposed to the raw spiritual depravity that those people exhibit every time we pass them. We just don't feel it, but we
I think
can in
really
dream.
good way to put it, you know, and I think a background to this is there was a camping spot that my ex-wife and I would go to with the dingo canoeing across this beautiful lake, and it did slightly occur to us that it was reachable by road from the other side. But of course, we were coming to it from canoe, and we didn't really think of it that way necessarily. But it was just a lovely, lovely camping spot. And once we got there, and fortunately it was still very, very daylight, and we had a chance to turn around, but there were slabs of the really just nastiest hamburger laid out across the barbecue pit. There were thousands of rounds of shotgun and 22 caliber bullets. There were beer cans. There were piles of the nastiest, cheapest cigarettes. And I
Yep.
just thought, you know, we could have camped there. We were going to camp there.
Yeah.
And these people might have come down this road. It would have been difficult. They would have had to make some effort. It was not an easy, it was off-road track, but it was possible. They obviously got there. And I thought to myself, you know, what would we have done? You know?
Yeah.
And it was just so nasty and awful. I mean, everything that you can imagine. Terrible food left to attract maggots and flies, S cheap cigarettes, the worst beer, and a shitload of shotgun shells and 22 rounds. I mean, yeah, those are the kind of people I want to hang out with, you know. I want to be there, you know, fucking my wife when those people roll down the track at midnight. Yep, that's the deal.
Very interesting.
And I think that's kind of still part of my, you know, and I just don't feel that way about America. I really don't. I know those people are here. I really do. I'm not being romantic at all, but I just don't worry about it the same way I do there, you know?
That is very interesting, and I do wonder what the difference there is. I think I'm going to have to think about that some more. This is a good episode, interview episode. Hope everybody enjoyed
Yeah.
it.
Well, it was fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate having Matthew O'Brien on. He's a really good dude. People can find him at beneaththeneon.com. And we will, Dave and I are going to have more guests as we roll out. I think we've got some really cool people coming up. We're always trying to do something new, scramble it up, throw some new pitches, you know, that kind of thing.
Cool. All right. Thanks, everybody.